If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's going on, Rugby Rant fans? It's the Hammer, and we are loaded with great guests this week. We've got one that, you know, comes on every once in a while, does a great job with his own pod, and I'm talking about none other than from the Bonus Point podcast, TJ Olson, one of my guys. What's up, TJ?
Hey, brother. Good to have myself on one of the best rugby podcasts in North America, if not the best. So I'm super excited to be back on the Rugby Rant. Yeah, and really, really excited to chat more about our upcoming topics. But yeah, had to wear my Rooney shirt today because we don't have Scott on the pod today. So I've got to represent in some way, shape, or form. So I'm happy to be on.
I want to bring that up. Guests, if you're waiting to see the big guy, the problem is his voice went bipolar. See, what happened is on Saturday, he's a Michigan fan, and Michigan got their ass kicked by, I believe, USC, if I'm not mistaken. And then his voice might have come around on Sunday because the Packers won big this weekend, and he had to give it a rest. And if there's one thing that we know Scott is known for, it's talking loud and not saying a lot. So he's given it a rest this weekend. But we've got, like I said, two great guests. The other great guest is someone who's been on the show quite frequently, but has been very busy in her own neck of the woods. And that's Karen Gasparino. Karen, what's going on with you?
I've been so busy the last couple of years with the Canadian Classics Rugby. I do communications for the women's side, which has been growing over six tours now, and we just did kind of like a curtain raiser 2 weeks in the UK. Three different teams traveled up and down the coast and saw two World Cup games, including USA versus England, and then of course our girls versus Fiji. It was fantastic being over there, and it's the Classics 30th anniversary this year, so the men had a big tour to Japan, and they're going back to Bermuda. They go every year, and so it's a really strong program, really growing strength to strength, so I've been rather busy with that.
Well, geez, I mean, talk about somebody just heavily steeped in rugby right now. That's amazing, and you guys in Canada just have to be chuffed at how well the women's team performed at the World Cup. And there were some individuals that just showed their absolute brilliance in that finals match and every match leading up to it, of course. And TJ will try not to make faces or funny noises, by the way, because New Zealand got pounded.
Hey, you can't go against it. I mean, like you have to give them props. I mean, honestly, you would obviously want me as a New Zealand fan to see the Black Ferns go on to try for the gold and compete against England. But hats off to a competition and a program that has been in the past self-funded, and they've gone through a whole transformation. I remember seeing a few years ago watching them for the competition down in San Diego when they played against New Zealand and Australia. They were doing that little camp against USA as well. And how much they've transformed their program over these years, it's phenomenal. So you can hate it as much as you want as a New Zealand fan, but you can't hate it as a footy fan because, my God, they're putting people on notice.
Yeah, they really did well. Of course, there are champions, and yes, there were some players that really stood out. Of course, Sophie, Asia, and to me, I really love Karen Paquin. She has done so much for the game itself. She's a phenomenal coach. But, you know, she keeps getting, out of the program, and then she keeps putting her hat back in and getting back into the program. Fourth World Cup, turned 38. I don't know of any player more phenomenal, and she was always there. And of course, you know, scored a couple tries too. So,
yeah, what's amazing to me, not just how well they played, it was absolutely brilliant, and they were so tough and so strong against, I mean, an almost unstoppable England side. But I think they forced a conversation within the larger scope of world rugby. And I may be going off on a tangent here. I apologize, folks, but I think it's worth noting that the success of the women's program, mark my words here, I think we may see a couple of men's games in 2031 played in Toronto, if for no other reason to set the table for 2033. And I would guess that we're going to see some pool play in 2033, simply on the backs and the strength of the women showing here in 2025. So that's just, I'm forecasting there, but they forced the hand, they forced the hand of world rugby, and that would be amazing.
Did you see who came, you know, to support them? Of course, we got the tragically hip, but, you know, Shania Twain, Russell Crowe. I mean,
yeah,
we had some pretty amazing backing, you know, when we went into that final.
100%. So I can't wait to see what the knock-on effect of their success was in 2025 and how that transitions into 2020, it's going to be 9 and then 2033. So kudos to the Rugby Canada women. They just did such a wonderful job, and especially to Sophie DeGoody, who was absolutely phenomenal, lights out player this year. But let's, before we get too far into the episode, I want to remind everybody of this. Reggie's, if you're in Chicago, join us down at Reggie's. My buddy Norm Smythe is putting on the rugby party. There is lots of stuff happening pregame and postgame, and I know that my guy TJ is coming into town for the event. He'll be joining Scott and I on the live pod. We're set to kick that off at noon, but the doors are going to open in the morning. I'm seeing a 10 o'clock open. There's going to be music, rugby Olympics. There's going to be wings, beer, chugging, arm wrestling, all sorts of festivities. Of course, the rugby ran, as I said, we're going to be jumping on. And then there's going to be some musical acts, a duo, and then shuttles begin at 1:30 to take everybody over to Soldier Field. The game will be on, so even if you are not in Soldier Field, you can watch it with a packed house at Reggie's and be there for the after party, which will be awesome. Surf Rock will be in the joint, and there's going to be ruggers all over the rooftop, so it should be outstanding. But, you know, check the link below and get yourself in the house so you have a good time on November 1st with TJ, Scott, and myself. And maybe Gazelle will make a run down because she's so excited that she doesn't want to, leak all over the place. So I'm kidding. But no, it's seriously, it's going to be great. Everybody's going to have a good time. With that, we're going to talk about some things happening around the rugby world here in just a moment. Each of us has a little bit to talk about, and we'll get to that here in just a couple minutes. But in the meantime, I got to find it. Holy cow, guys. Without Scott, my producer, I'm lost. Scott, where are you when I need you? Oh, here we go. Around the pitch. All right. Around the pitch, we're going to each talk about something that's happened in our part of the world. I'm going to start first with the Gaz.
Well, I touched on the classics, and of course, Rugby Canada doing so well, and then just following what what's going on here in terms of school rugby and club rugby. We're wrapping up, but getting ready, I guess, for what might come in the following season. So really my big story was classics and how much I've got going on with that.
That's awesome. By the way, can I just ask on that note, how are Canadians who are plugged into rugby taking the news that the MLR potentially is going to turn Canadians into foreign players rather than domestic players?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, that's rough, right? Because there's so many of us down there. And if you start capping, if we start having to be included in the cap, then that includes all of, you know, your South American players as well. So that's going to take a lot of Canadians out. And considering we no longer have our own team, I think that that's really unfortunate. It's really exclusive. When we were trying to build the league together. There was always still so much hope that a Canadian team would come back, but I don't know what this does. And I think it really, right now, it's just leaving such a bitter taste, really.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. Although I got to tell you, once again, I'm putting my forecaster hat on. I believe that World Rugby is going to come through and support a return of Canadian team. On this, an effort to give more Canadian players an opportunity to play together that, you know, build towards a national program. But will it happen in 2026? I don't know. But I'm guessing if it does happen, it's more likely 2027. So it'll be interesting to see if that kind of forces the issue or if that's kind of part of the plan. But that aside, let's talk to TJ, who's down in that SoCal region. What's happening down in your neck of the woods?
Well, it's not necessarily local news, but it's definitely something that I'm plugged into, and that is rugby going on in New Zealand. If you haven't been watching Bunnings NPC, the local provincial competition in New Zealand, they are into their semi-finals at the moment. Bit of a surprise that both of the provincial games for the semi-finals are going to be in the South Island. Not that the South Island hasn't been doing outstanding for years and years and years. I'm thinking about the Crusaders, who have won 6 back-to-back titles for the Super Rugby. But Otago kind of shocked everyone by being one of the big powerhouses in the NPC this year. So it's going to be Bay of Plenty playing Otago this weekend. And also it's going to be Hawke's Bay, who have been the favourites, taking on Canterbury. So we're really excited to see those two matches. I think this has honestly been the best year of Bunnings NPC that I've seen in a long time. And that's just not me plugging New Zealand rugby. It's just a fact. It's been outstanding. I think the fact that we've seen All Blacks come back into squads and those teams have been beaten, it really shows how really tight that competition is at the moment and just how much the development is coming through the grassroots at the moment in New Zealand rugby.
And folks, that's why we love bringing TJ on, because he talks about rugby in that part of the world in his Bonus Point podcast. If you haven't seen it, check it out. You're going to get your full on, attention of South Pacific Island rugby, you know, from NPC to, you know, the Super Rugby, all kinds of awesome stuff coming out of there. So check out the Bonus Point podcast. He never ceases to have a great show. And that's the truth, folks. Book it right here. TJ, I got to ask you real quick before, because you are the foremost expert here in the United States on all things happening down in the South Pacific down there. I got to ask you, looking online with the 2 losses, 1 to Argentina, 1 to South Africa, there have been a lot of calls for Razor's Head. Are these premature?
100%. You can't look at this campaign and say that Razor hasn't been doing a good job. Can he do better? Can his staff do better? Can his players do better? 100%. There's obviously glaring gaps in our games. Like, I think if you look at the aerial battle, we struggled throughout the whole rugby championship. It was quite obvious there were a variety of injuries. There were other things, and these aren't me making excuses, but the All Blacks were losing before this and we've improved since then. So I think if people are looking at Razor and saying we've got to we've got to take him out of there. Tell me who's a better person to put in there, because I don't see someone who is a better candidate. But I think it's more so speaks to how even the rugby championship is. The end of it came down to point differential. South Africa, they didn't have the best rugby championship either. I think it was more so they were also dealing with injuries. They were dealing with chop and change that they were experimenting. But the competition was so close. People were saying that Australia could have potentially won it, and they haven't won a rugby championship or a Bledisloe in years. So, yeah, long story short, I definitely think keeping Razor in there is our best bet to be successful. Give him some time.
Yeah, you raise good points. Who do you get to replace him? You know, that's a big question. But I think for me, and the other thing is, it's like, as professionalism has got more steeped into rugby, you know, now we're looking at 1995, almost 30 years on now. We can't expect New Zealand to always be at the top. You know, we're seeing other nations kind of expand their abilities under professionalism. And it was always the Kiwis that were just, you know, one step ahead of the curve. And now the professionalism is really well steeped in rugby. You know, that there are lots of rugby unions getting more and more professional, getting more and more, honing in on that. And the margins are going to be smaller, and it's going to make it more difficult for New Zealand to stay on top. But, don't count them out. I think they're a team in transition that's transitioning their roster a little bit. They've got a couple guys that are older, but as they transition to 2027, I think we're going to see a squad that's going to be ripe for success.
Yeah. So, I think on that point, just quickly, is you've obviously got the debate is, was the 2011-2015 New Zealand team better versus South Africa 2019-2023? Like, that's a raving debate at the moment. We're way past 2011-2015. There were too many superstars on that side. And I get all these questions like, oh, what do you feel about Argentina beating the All Blacks? And I'm saying, it's great for rugby. You don't want to see the same team win every time. It keeps it entertaining. You're on the edge of your seat. This we're living in a new age, but it's a great age of rugby.
Yeah. And I think Australia, the fact that Australia is really coming around at the right time is good for rugby as well. But you know what else is good for rugby? To talk about a new league that's emerged. And that's going to be the folks of the Rugby Rant today. That's why TJ and Karen have been asked to join, because they really are plugged into this topic. Rugby 360 is kind of this rogue league that has taken shape, spearheaded by the face Mike Tindall, of course, of England World Cup champion fame. But it's backed by some Middle Eastern money, and there's some real questions about this competition or the potential for this competition. And we're going to be talking about this and breaking it down for you in the Rugby Rant. But first, we're going to get a word from our sponsors at Macron. All right, so we're talking Rugby 360, and yes, I stole this, folks. Bold Frontier, Risky Game Changer. But more than that, we're going to be talking about some things that are much more specific. Three areas that we're going to plug into right now, and that's number one. The big question is player interest. Like, what kind of players might be interested in being lured away from their professional contracts in other competitions? Okay, so that's number one. And in with that, player welfare, because that's one of the considerations when you're talking about this new league. Some questions about player welfare have been thrown out. The other piece is marketability. With every new league, there's a big question of can they get a bigger market share of the rugby community and the sporting community? So that's the big question insofar as, you know, that's what drives revenue. But then finally, fan interest. And that's tied to revenue, of course, because that's butts and seats. But more than that, you know, are they going to be able to get peak fan interest and engage fans from around the world as we talk about this model? So let me just kind of sum up some important things about Rugby 360 before we move on. From what I've gathered, it's a union competition. As I said, Mike Tyndall is the face. He's the co-founder, along with Eddie Jones and Chris Webb, are there to recruit players. As I said, there's some money coming in from the Middle East, kind of like the LIV structure. Some people from LIV, I think the lawyer for LIV Golf, is tied into this. So supposedly some details. October of 2026 is going to be the first year, 6 male teams, 4 female teams. And then in 2027, it'll go for a 12 event competition that will run from April to September. And they're going to grow in 2027 to 8 male teams in 2028. They're supposed to have 16 events that run from April, September with, I believe, a gap for the international window. The initial teams that have been talked about are, going to be from London, Miami, Tokyo, Dubai, Boston, Cape Town, Lisbon, and Madrid. It'll be registered to the UAE Rugby Football Union. That's United Arab Emirates. And there's one point that we'll bring in is players are supposedly going to own their own IP, not by a team or R360. There will be a draft in July of 2026. And this is interesting. Players will not have to reside in the franchise location, but they will be able to choose their country of residence. So those are kind of some of the skeleton structure of this league. And I'm sure that both Karen and TJ will kind of pull in elements that I've just mentioned as they talk about it. So first, let's tackle the question of players, right? And player interest and player welfare. So will this league, and I'll start with Karen, will this league be able to pull players in to make it a cornerstone league rugby? I mean, it's rugby union, but a rugby competition is probably the better way to put it in the rugby world.
Well, there's a couple of things there. First of all, not if they want to play internationally. 8 out of the top 10 countries have their unions have released a joint statement saying that they have more questions than answers and that they do not back this league, that they feel like this league is counterintuitive to what rugby is trying to do in terms of its growth, and certainly that it interrupts the national window. It doesn't interrupt the national window, but it does interrupt competition windows, certainly Champions Cup, etc. And that it it's a lot of, so far, a lot of really great bells and whistles. A lot of what you said, Rob, was really like attractive to potential players. But how much of that is it's too good to be true? That is my point number two, which is the players' unions. The RFU has come out and said, guys, I don't really think that this is something that you should consider, especially if you want to continue your international career. But also, you know, there are a lot of questions, and player welfare is right at the top of that. You know, what if paydays can't happen? If you look at, you know, pro rugby, people weren't paid. Players played many games and then it had to walk away. There's just so many questions, and it's such an expensive undertaking. And there's all of these kinds of guarantees being made. Mike Tyndall sat down with 200 players. Apparently, there were kind of like pre-contracts signed by these 200 players. I think it was more of a meeting. He might have had some handshakes. Nobody knows, because they're not saying anything, because a lot of the players don't want to say anything because they don't want to upset their union, and they're kind of like waiting to see what happens. But I think personally, the the players that this would really appeal to the most are the ones that have basically aged out of international or have found themselves out of favor internationally and who aren't done yet. They're still a draw. They're still popular players. They're still star quality. So people will want to go see them. But they're no longer really even thinking in terms of international playing time anymore. So that's there. That's all.
Yeah, and I think you raised some great points, particularly the aged out factor. You know, who does it appeal to? Well, if you know you're not going to be playing for your national team any longer, and there's money to be made, then there's obvious appeal there. But if you have an opportunity to still play for your national team, then you might be willing to sacrifice some of that money for the other things that you gain, the other monetary gains that you get from playing with your national team. And I'm curious, you know, from your standpoint, TJ, having been both plugged into Australia and New Zealand and the United States, but in particular, you know, the Pacific Islands and some of those players down there, you know, is there interest from players in the South Pacific, from, you know, Australia, New Zealand, in this type of model?
I think there's definitely interest, whether it is, I guess, preliminary or something that's just going to be talked about versus like actual interest, like they're ready to sacrifice their contracts and their well-being and how they support their families is a whole nother thing. I think the fact that you see the instability of professional rugby at the moment, where the club game is cash strapped, like more than a dozen professional outfits over the years have crumbled. I'm thinking of the Melbourne Rebels in Australia. I'm thinking of the Wasps out in the UK. A lot of top flight rugby programs have just crumbled underneath. So I think it's that point where people are sitting here going, where's my security? Like this potentially could all crumble around me anyway. But I wholeheartedly agree on what Gaz was saying. I think it's when you're looking at players that are interested in this possibility, it could be crossover athletes. So people coming from potentially rugby league, potentially even American football. You know, you've had guys in the past like Nate Ebner, who's played for the Sevens, who has also played for the Patriots. I'm thinking of Roger Tuivasa-Sheck, who had a stint in New Zealand playing for the All Blacks, and now he's back in rugby league. He's definitely on the back end of his career. Definite fringe players like a Peter Umanga-Jensen, who's currently playing over in Japan, who was looked at as one of the greatest centers to play in New Zealand at one point, and he couldn't even get a sniff in the All Blacks at the moment, even if he wanted to. So there's definitely players there who don't have international, I guess, interests or opportunities to go and give that a go. But I think one example I want to utilize is that we never know what can happen and when your opportunity can come is John Alfour. He's a 40-year-old prop that was barely playing rugby. He was playing over in France and he was about to retire, and then he got a call up to go play for the Crusaders, and he almost won a championship with them. So you never know when your time can come. We see in the All Blacks a bunch of centres and scrum halves and other people were going down getting injured, and we had to scrape the bottom of the barrel to get people in there to play scrum half for the All Blacks. So I think if you're looking at the potential opportunity of playing for your international side, which unless you've called it quits on your own time, you never know when your time can come, whether you're on the back end of your career or you're still in it. I know a lot of guys are looking at the cash aspect and trying to provide for their families, but they won't sacrifice now that New Zealand, England, France, South Africa, all these unions have stepped in. They won't sacrifice the potential to play for the international team.
You know, it's funny when Karen, when you were talking about players that have aged out, and you combine that with what TJ, you were mentioning about players that might, you know, see an opportunity. I think of a guy like James O'Connor, Jock, right, who is pretty much in the wasteland, like was, you know, he's 35, wasn't even being considered by Australia. He, Hey, look, I'm gonna tell you this right now from a very reputable source, somebody that I closely speak with on a regular basis here on the MLR. He was a hair's sniff away from being in the MLR. He got a call from the Crusaders, went down there, and kind of resurrected his international career of sorts, right? So might we see a guy like that in that mold where he'd say, look, I'm going to take a year contract. Yeah, I'll make $1 million or $2 million or whatnot. Gives me a little bit of security for my family. But at the end of that contract, you never know. A national side could need my service. And therefore, it doesn't necessarily mean the end of my career. I could play well enough that if a team is low on scrum halves or fly halves or whatever, my home nation, they come calling. You know, is there a player, a potential for players to do something like that with this as the model?
There's a lot. I'd say there's a lot of them that would do that. I mean, it's 3 months out of their lives, so it doesn't really impact them too much if they have families and they have to move for 3 months. I mean, it's no different than any other professional athlete. And I think a lot of them would definitely, you know, see the dollar signs because there are a lot of lucrative promises being made, but that is what worries me.
Yeah. I 100% agree. I think I mentioned this off air before the recording. Like, I think this is trying to be rugby's answer to LIV Golf, a cash rich league shaking up tradition. And I think in this day and age, when so many stereotypes and things are being broken in this new world in sports, where we're always trying to innovate, we're always trying to do new things. Rugby athletes at the bottom line are competitors. They want to be on the front line of cutting edge. They want to be on the line of something new. So if they get an opportunity to do something where they get to be that person that broke into that competition that turned out to be the big one, there's going to be some people that are going to want to do it. And I agree, there's arguments with both sides, but like Karen said, it could be the rugby's next Netflix generation, or it could be a destined generational bust, like pro rugby versus MLR at the moment, how we would be able to use that. So yeah, there's definitely both sides to the argument. I'm the same with Karen. It makes me nervous as all hell.
Something that I think is making some players perhaps nervous, but making others in the rugby stratosphere nervous, is that issue that we talked about with regard to player welfare. Obviously, player welfare is on the minds of rugby players. Recently, former England captain, and I've got Mike Tindall on my mind, but
Lewis Moody.
Lewis Moody mentioned, had just come out this week, said he had essentially, well, in America we call it Lou Gehrig's disease, but it's it's a neurological disorder. And so that's got to be on people's minds, is player welfare. What's the plan? It's interesting. Wales Online article from October 8th by Ben James that talks about this Rugby 360. He quotes Mike Tindall when he says that, let me find the quote. So many players love what 360 can do for them and for the game. Can't wait for it to kick off. Player welfare is one of the key reasons for creating our global series, which will greatly reduce player load and capture the attention of a new generation of fans globally. Right? That's directly from Mike Tindall. Now, here's my question, though. Coincidentally, World Rugby just released its own player welfare kind of structure this week. It's a 30-game limit they're talking about, a limit of 6 consecutive weeks of play before a rest period, a mandatory 5-week off-season break for all players, international duty breaks, at least 1 week of rest following international fixtures, a minimum of 12 weeks of no contact across the year, and then post-World Cup, a mandatory 1 week off from training after World Cup, followed by a week of non-contact training. Here's my question. Given what Tindall was trying to achieve in that quote, and given that World Rugby just released their welfare guidelines, is World Rugby kind of trying to take away, preempt Rugby 360 in a sense, and take away part of its thunder and appeal to players?
Well, isn't it making it impossible if it's a 3-month stint?
Yeah, it would be. Well, and if it's not sanctioned, the big question, if it's not sanctioned by World Rugby, that is Rugby 360, you know, does that count? You know, will World Rugby consider it? Or because it's a rogue league, how will they view that? You know, it's kind of interesting in that sense. So
I think if you look at it, there's again, two sides of the coin. So I think if you look at the 3-month stint, obviously reduced workload. So you get a little more time to yourself. You can focus on rehab, prehab, all those types of things. If you do have any niggling injuries, you can also, I think outside of the financial security that is supposedly being offered, What I've heard is that the global exposure and the player branding that players can take opportunity from, they can take outside deals. They can utilize Rugby 360 as an opportunity to set up their next 10, 20 years, whether that be different brand opportunities, things like that, that they wouldn't be able to get through their provincial clubs. But on the flip side of that, the things that I like to think about that will really suffer a huge detriment is the grassroots and the pathway for grassroots. I think if you open this floodgate, we don't know what's going to happen. If we take governance out of it, if we take just a streamlined process, I've been on this podcast multiple times talking about how much I have detested in the past USA Rugby's pathway and how there's not a clear one. And it's definitely gotten better over the years. I think it's going to be very difficult to make an argument how the grassroots and those pathways won't get impacted and the travel demands. If all these places that they're going to in this small period, they have to travel all over, it's going to be pretty, pretty tough for the player welfare to be, I guess, at tip top. So yeah, I think there's definitely arguments for both. And I think when you think about the financial capacity, I'm thinking about the opportunities for the women who don't necessarily get those big paychecks who could really benefit from this. But yeah, again, there's just too many things that I look at that I just feel unsure and just uneasy about.
So if World Rugby isn't going to sanction this, right, so there's all that level of red tape, let's say, that World Rugby takes care of in terms of player welfare, you know, insurance and so a player gets hurt and this league ends up folding. What about that player's ongoing care where with World Rugby, it's such a massive, you know, figurehead. You don't really have to worry about that. So, I mean, that's another kind of red flag for me. Who's going to ensure that the players are okay if something does happen? And if you have a player that's on long-term disability, for example?
It's an interesting question because obviously, you know, a player that's playing in service to the national team is going to be cared for by the union and their insurance is provided by the union. The same holds true if they're playing, you know, the MLR or they're playing club rugby here in the United States, or for that matter, you know, in the NPC or whatever, their insurance is carried through the union and they're going to be covered. But what we don't know is that insurance piece, which is one of the most expensive parts of running any rugby competition. Is aside from payroll, is you know, that healthcare component, right? So that's, you know, in a year's time, this is supposed to be boots on the ground, you know, players in grass, and they're supposed to be playing. Yet we don't have that detail ironed out. So that's a fair point, Karen. TJ, you were going to add to that part of the conversation. I felt like
no, I yeah I. No, I'm just more so agreeing. I think in regards to player welfare, unless there is something written in contracts or there is something that in the event of bankruptcy, in the event of something folding like this potential figurehead or this corporation would continue to hold on to and support them. But again, in the legal world that we live in, there's so many loopholes out of that there's no ever guarantee that this person isn't going to get taken care of. It's you would have to pay out of pocket. You would have to think about what's going to happen for the next 10, 20 years. Yeah, again, too much instability. I'm not here for it.
I hear you. TJ, you mentioned that players, and I talked about it, players are going to own their own intellectual property, their own IP, as it's called. And you mentioned that this is a big, this is attractive factor or feature of this league. And certainly the idea to be able to position themselves and market themselves beyond their playing career. So I want to talk about that piece now, the marketability. Is the marketability for this rogue league there?
I personally feel like if this competition got off the ground and everything was ironed out, or at least to a point where everybody can be happy with what will come of the other side, the sky is literally the limit for this competition in regards to marketability and the ways they can interact with fans. I'm thinking of what people are looking for when it comes to a big party, where you think of Wellington Sevens, you think of Vegas Sevens. People enjoyed that competition so much because of how much, I guess, electricity it brought to the engagement of the fans. Obviously, Vegas was pushed off the cliff because of the player conditions. They don't want to go to a place like that. So again, that's another player welfare thing you have to look at. But if you think of giving something for fans to really be excited about, I think they can build it out pretty well. And I also feel like they've got so many different opportunities they can go. They can do like digital fan engagement. They can go into locker rooms. They can do meet and greets before and after. They can do so many things that maybe other unions weren't allowing or doing that. And again, these are things that come down to player welfare, but they know what they're getting into when they sign up for this type of league. It's going to be big. It's going to be extravagant, and that's what they're getting paid for. I think by blending entertainment, interactive, tech, community, engagement, there's so many opportunities, but the players have got to be willing to do it.
So I guess here my question then is the structure of this, is it inherently built into the structure that the IP and all those pieces will fall into place? Or is this just a league that sees how to connect those pieces, TJ, much better than the old heads and all the other unions? I mean, I don't see any reason why those things can't happen within the current structures if a union is, if an organization is able to do it. I mean, just look here at the MLR. I think there are teams that do a pretty good job at connecting fans with players. And then the Hounds allow players onto the field after every game. And the players really, truly enjoy meeting with fans, and they spend a lot of time doing so. There's no reason why that can't be done in other leagues. So what makes this league so different, I guess, is my question. And on the back end of that, to me, players owning IP might even be a little bit more limiting. For example, just think of like producing a video game. Right, you're going to have to negotiate the likeness with every player that's in the league in order to put quality content on a video game, for example. It's one of the reasons why the NCAA had such difficulty in putting out a video game between, you know, its first iteration of what's out now, is getting players on board. Doesn't it? So in other words, does it do anything that more expansive that can't be done under current conditions? And in some sense, isn't it limiting? So it's kind of a double question that I have for you guys.
No. Well, Karen, you want to go?
Well, I was going to say, if you own your own IP, then the expenses fall to you as well. Like, you've got to hire people to take care of that for you. You've got to have really good lawyers. You've got to have agents involved at all levels too. So, I mean, really, like, if you're talking about big paydays, a lot of that pay is going to go elsewhere to take care of your image.
Yeah, it's kind of funny you mentioned that, because I know that there are some players in the NFL that don't even handle their own social media, right? They leave it to somebody in their entourage of sorts that they pay to do that, right? So that's an interesting point and a fair point, that they're going to have to hire somebody to manage their IP. And you know, we're talking about you know, making $1 to $2 million, not like an NFL quarterback who's making $50 to $60 million.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the only thing that I am seeing that is the upside in the hand of Rugby 360 is there's so much up in the air at the moment that we don't know where they could take it. Again, like to your point, I do love the fact that the rugby players, for example, when San Diego came and played RFCLA, like, they all stuck around, they all hung out, they all got to engage with fans, sign autographs and do those types of things. But I do see pretty glaring gaps in regards to updates, in regards to games, watchability. Are they going to be able to broadcast these games on free-to-air as opposed to doing it on an ESPN or something else like that? So, yeah, again, there isn't too much that I don't see that unions and clubs at the moment couldn't do to engage fans, to push the narrative that they're providing all of these things. But again, they have a lot of different people to answer to in regards to their unions, their sponsors, a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. Rugby 360 may still have that, but it's only a handful of people that have got their hands in the pot at the moment. So as long as they've got agreements with their sponsors where they're going to run it how they see fit and they won't disparage or besmirch their name, they could do things that other unions, other competitions can't. And this isn't me saying, oh, I'm in fan of it. It's just there's so much potential upside that I don't know that what they could do. There's just so many things.
Another question, you know, that I have is about the start date. So they really want to get going they're talking April to June of 2027, but they have a planned start date of October 2026. They haven't really said like how many games they're talking in October of 2026. That would interrupt autumn internationals. And then it's really not a very long period of time between saving up to go to Dubai to see one of these games in October of 2026, and then suddenly you're wanting to go and catch a couple on the circuit in 2027. It just seems like that's awfully tight timeline between the first go, which they haven't been very clear about, and the second season.
Yeah, that is a great point. You know, it's just, they don't allow much opportunity for the league to breathe, to make changes and adjust, which, by the way, I think is, you know, like TJ, I don't know that I'm a fan of this idea or concept. I'd have to hear more. But I will say one of the advantages of it is that it's flexibility and structure, right? Because this league doesn't fall necessarily under World Rugby, they also aren't bound by the rules of World Rugby. Now, right now they're saying it's going to be a union game, but could they easily change some elements to make it more like rugby league, which we know has some popularity, particularly in Australia and New Zealand? Could they make it more rugby league like? Could they adjust the rules to bring down, like, for example, to create more commercial opportunities, right? So, you know, one of the things that hampers rugby is the fact that, you know, at least at the international level, you know, you have 40 minutes that you're playing of constant gameplay, which is great for the entertainment value, doesn't leave a lot of opportunities for commercialization, right? You have to put your on-field images and things like that. But can they find a way to do that? Can they adjust the game to create more time and play so that when that clock is running, that, you know, there's more action? And a league like this has that opportunity to be more flexible and adaptable to what fans want. And that is where I think they have an advantage over the current structures, is that flexibility, because they can be what fans want it to be of sorts, what, you know, mm-hmm. their fans are telling it they want it to be. And they can be adaptable. So it's kind of the advantage, like, it's one of the advantages of rugby league, from what I understand, is it's more of a top-down structure. There aren't a lot of unions that play rugby or that play league, so that the NRL can really be adaptable. Yeah, they can play in Vegas and have two games that are played in Vegas and really bring the game to the States. So they could do other things to make it adaptable and amenable to the needs and fit what they want to achieve, which is, I think, the advantage of this organization.
No, I agree. I think if you look at a example of Super Rugby, when they introduced the 50-22 rule, it was something right. where people were very like, oh, this is awesome. It provides a lot more variety in the game. You have to change defensive structures to account for that. And you couldn't put that into the international window until World Rugby had implemented and saw its success. So I definitely agree. They could alter more rules. Another example is like the MLR's 7-point try when you score under the post. Right. Like there's so many variations you could potentially add in there to make it more of a fan centric game. Could they tailor to the more novice fans and take out scrums completely? It's something where they've got so many options. I don't personally like that, even though me being a back formerly, I love seeing a good scrum and I love seeing the technicalities and screaming at the TV when I think it's one penalty, but it's actually something else. But it's something. Yeah, you're 100% right, Rob. They've got this opportunity to go in so many different directions. Again, like I said, with the markability, again, with the opportunities of how they run the event and do certain things. Sky's the limit.
At the same time, you've got to be really careful, because there's an awful lot of people that mm-hmm. really do like the traditional game. And sure, do they want maybe a little bit more fanfare? Yeah, I think that we could all enjoy a little bit more fanfare. The whole festival feel at a World Cup game, you cannot replicate anywhere. And yeah, I'm all for that. But at the same time, I want to enjoy the four elements of the game that I really enjoy. I don't want any of those taken away, and I would balk at that. And you'd have an awful lot of old timers balking at it as well. And really, if you're talking about a festival atmosphere and you're talking about touring to go and probably people going in groups and wearing the group costumes and bringing in some of that sevens element, you're talking about people that have money. And if you're going to change all the rules, you're going to eliminate all the people that have money.
Yeah.
Interesting. So you guys are hitting upon our final note, fan interest / fan engagement. And you both have talked about this idea of festival style. We know that the HSBC 7 series has that festival style. Certainly TJ talked about just the love affair that Americans had with the American rugby fans had with the Vegas Sevens. You mentioned the Vancouver Sevens had a lot of support from our neighbors to the north. And we know, for example, the PLL here in the United States, that's the Premier Lacrosse League, it started it and it still operates as a festival style. So my question is, will a world festival style like this be successful? Will it attract interest from rugby fans around the world?
Yes and no. I mean, I think, again, potential, but you look at the numbers that have come from a variety of different sevens tournaments at the moment. They've tried to provide as much as they can in regards to fan engagement and things like that. the opportunity for that festival feel, and you still see numbers dwindle. But it, again, this is just me thinking of, I'm always thinking of both sides of the coin. You see how many people flock to certain places for the Grand Prix, for certain things, that it is like that exclusive feeling. It's that like once in a lifetime time. Whereas I went to go see the Grand Prix in 2023 or something like that. So I think if you partner that with early ticket releases, VIP access for different things, behind the scenes things, different watch parties that they could have if they partner with local brands and local partners, tie in sponsors and integrate like campaigns and things like that. If they can market that and showcase that and people gauge interest, then yes. But yeah, again, I think to Gaz's point, rugby comes from tradition, and that's what it's always stemmed from. I think if we do start to go too far away from that, people are going to see through the glass, and it's just not going to have the same feel. You can't replicate what we've been doing for years and years, and what I get excited about. That's why I stay up till 2 a.m. watching the All Blacks live. Like, that's something that I'm not going to do that for a Rugby 360, because I just don't have that passion, that excitement. So yeah, again, so much opportunity for things they could do. I just don't see the engagement getting off the ground to an extent like that.
I'm going to agree with you fully on that one. I'm also going to add that, you know, in order for the fans to flock and to spend their money, there will be players they want to see, and they will want to see their heroes do what their heroes do. So if you got a Joe Marler involved and he was no longer, you know, scrummaging, I mean, why is he there? Like, why am I watching him? I want to watch him be a nuisance in the scrum. You know, so I think that, you know, it's kind of like, it's a little bit twofold, isn't it? Like, you can't not expect there to be big players in order for the people to come and see them. And yet you can't expect the people to come that see them want to see them do something different and new.
Interesting. So I've got a question. We're talking about fan engagement, and to me, what draws fan, why is it that the Six Nations arguably is one of the best rugby union competitions? Now, I know I'm going to get a kickback from TJ, but just in terms of attention, the Six Nations is one of the best rugby union comps, right? And one can argue that in part that comes from national allegiances and national rivalries, yes. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like the England will call the French frogs all day long and twice on Sunday, and the French will call the English palms every other Saturday. Every one of the other home nations wants to see the other one beat England, right? That's what makes the competition awesome and fun. Without any loyalties or allegiances that are national, where'd I go? Will fans lose that connection?
Yes, they will.
Yeah.
And therefore, what will be the connection that will draw fans into this league?
There's not much. I mean, I think the only thing that you could think of, I could think of, is like something like you're helping support and boost the local economy of these places going, which a lot of these places that they're going to are pretty well off already. I mean, you're looking at Dubai, you're looking at Monaco, like that for me would be the only reason where I would sit there and go, okay, I would go to a certain place, or I would go and do something if it was able to help the community, because we are a community-based game. We want to get around and we want to help people. We want to drive the game as well. And if it's done through the right ways and initiatives, then yeah. But yeah, to your point, and to Karen's point multiple times, it's like, it's embedded so deeply in rugby culture, in these certain competitions where even me, like you said, Rob, not my favorite competition to watch because I'm a rugby championship man through and through. And even though I don't believe the Netflix documentary was done the best it could, I'm still sitting there thinking about the Italy match of them talking about like they get to beat this team for the first time in how many years because they toiled and toiled and they pulled their community together. They pulled their rugby program together and they were able to get on top of that team. We have no allegiances. We have nothing that we can pull from that really has that history, that heart that we can go from. Could it be replicated and then we could become fans of those leagues? Yeah, potentially. Everything has that potential. But yeah, I just don't see if you put them next to each other, it's not apples and apples. It's apples and oranges.
Yeah, like they've talked about.
Sorry, Rob.
Go ahead.
I was going to say there'd have to be a lot of creativity involved. They'd have to like write the script, wouldn't they? They'd have to create rivalries. They'd have to create cups. You know, these two teams are going for this cup, and and these two players, they spent, you know, 20 years bashing each other on the pitch and now they're head to head, and they'd have to really play that up. And I'm sure with the money that's involved and mm-hmm. Tindall's no dummy. I mean, and he's been around the game his whole entire life. I'm sure that they will create these things, but I don't want disingenuous. I want the genuine article and I want the McCormick Cup, you know, like that's what I want. Like, I don't want something that is manufactured.
I think Karen Stone are really, it's a saying back home, it's a spanner in the works, like a wrench in the works. I think if this is kind of the thing that I'm thinking about, if we make this the WWE of rugby and then we script all the games and we market the promos and do everything, that's one reason why I'll go and watch it. If you can, even though you know it's fake, you still have fans coming back and you watch these things because they're the cliffhangers and the moments are so good. You sit there and go, how can I not watch that?
I can't wait to watch Joe Marler slap somebody across the scrum before the engagement.
Mate, you would go and watch that. I swear. Come on. Like that would be insane. So, I mean, Karen, get on the horn and tell them, be like, if they want to make it happen, the first couple of years, it's got to be all scripted WWE style where they go in there and they get it all done.
Honestly, WWE came into my head. Honestly, I was thinking that. I was totally thinking Hulk Hogan off the ropes. Like, you know, it's like, but that's just not for me. I mean, I'm just giant eye roll the whole time. Like, whatever.
Yeah, I got to tell you, never was really in, and I did actual school wrestling, like folk style wrestling when I was a kid, and I never had the appeal and still haven't ever had the appeal to WWE. So it wasn't like, I didn't transition well as a fan from one style of wrestling to the other. But I got to ask you more specifically, there's been, and this is kind of the last question before we close it out, Boston and Miami have been discussed as two cities that can be involved. I mentioned that at the top of the discussion. Is this a reality? I mean, do we really think that? I mean, there's the only country that'll have two, according to what's been reported, two cities involved. Do we really expect it to be sustainable, to these two cities to be sustainable and supported by American rugby fans?
I don't reckon. it's going to be tough. I mean, those are, I think if we're talking about seeing through the looking glass and seeing through bullcrap, pardon my French, like those Boston fans aren't going to get behind like another league. They're like, you can see how passionate their fan base is over there. They're through and through. They'll travel all the way across the country just to scream at LA fans. And I've seen it point blank. It's going to happen, but yeah. I mean, if you get another team in there, maybe, but I don't see it. It's, if those are the two towns, those are not places where I'm going to sit there and see the fan engagement.
I think that the MLR is, you know, struggling a tiny bit. And I mean, just in the last week, so many of the teams, the MLR itself has released these statements to say, hey guys, we're not going anywhere. We're holding fast. There will be growth. Hang tight and watch it happen. But if you water it down and you start introducing something new, it isn't gonna be as good, right? Like, who wants watered down Coke? Nobody, right? So you just like, I don't know. I don't. You can clearly see that I'm not. I like Mike Tyndall. And I like Stuart Hooper. I don't like this.
Yeah. And I just Boston, Miami. You're right, TJ. I don't see the Free Jacks fans have a great fan base there. They have one of the best in the league, arguably, and they'll go to the mattresses for the Free Jacks. I don't foresee many of those fans transitioning to this new league. Miami, not so sure about it. I think the Miami has an advantage. That's a destination. People might go to Miami just simply because it's Miami and they want to experience that town and that community. But are there people that support a Miami team because it's Miami? I don't know. It's more of a transient, it's more of a transient community. It's kind of like Vegas, right? Is that you're going to get like in the NFL, there were more Chicago Bears fans that attended that Vegas Chicago game than there were necessarily Vegas fans. And so you might get people traveling to Miami, but will you develop a fan base? Not so sure. Not so sure. So, but hey, guys, I think this is an interesting element. If anything, for me, this league, one of the things let me phrase this the right way. One of the things that bonds communities together is a threat. Any type of external threat has the ability to unify people in a group, right? And there's 9/11 did that for the United States, for members of the United States, and the whole of Western community. World War II, the threat of Nazis, and brought many Western cultures together to fight against that threat of Nazism, right? And I think the threat of this rogue rebel organization might cause the community of World Rugby to come together and kind of become a little bit better, to get itself a little bit better organized. That might be the knock-on effect here. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if this has legs. I'm not sure if it's gonna have the sustainability and gonna be able to pay out players beyond a season or two, but it might just have the impact of causing us to do what we do better. And quite frankly, I think that's happened with the MLR. The fact that it had to consolidate, we're seeing teams, and we're seeing with this last announcement that Karen talked about, that last announcement caused the owners that are in to sharpen their stone a little bit more. And maybe that's what happens with World Rugby. It says we have to sharpen our stone a little bit more. We have to become better at what we do. Otherwise, this external threat might make a go and make a run. I don't know. So it remains to be seen. It'll be interesting to see what developments come out of the next, 3 to 6 months, to see where this league goes, to see if it has any legs. Obviously, Middle Eastern money can at least make a go of something in the short term, but will it have the long-term legs to really change things in rugby as Tyndall foresees it? That's the big question that remains to be seen. So, TJ, Karen, I appreciate you guys joining tonight and talking about Rugby 360. It should be interesting. And as we get closer to the MLR season, you guys are both welcome to return and talk about it. Of course, fans tune in to the Rugby Rant on November 1st. TJ will be making an appearance here in Chicago, and we look forward to it. Scott, TJ, and the Hammer will be in the same place at the same time. So we will not be an AI product by any stretch of the imagination. Anybody who's there will be able to verify that. So, with that, folks, again, we're trying to, grow rugby one fan at a time, and we do that by engaging fans like TJ, like Karen, in what we do. And I want to thank both of you for joining the Rugby Rant this evening.
Thanks very much for having me, Hammer.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. No, always a pleasure to be on, mate. I can't wait to see what is next post November 1st, because we know we're going to have a cracker of a time. It's let's see if we all make it out of there.
I look forward to the photos. Right.
Yeah, it'll be an absolute great time. And if you're in the Chicago for that weekend, come join us down at Reggie's. There's going to be a lot of fun to be had all over this town. It should be an absolute cracker of a time. But with that, the Rugby Rant, we'll see you next week. This has been episode 223 of the Rugby Rant, and we will see everybody at the next.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.